Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week on the podcast, Ali Carter, who's been one of snooker's leading players for the last 10 years and has also had a lot of well-publicised health problems. And I have a good chat this week with Ali, who's a real tough character. He's had to be, I think, to come through it all, not just about his career on the table, but about all the things that have happened off the table as well. Ali, tell us how you got into snooker. How did you discover the game?
I discovered the game by my dad bought a 6x3 foot snooker table and put it in the front room at home when I lived in a little village called Tollesbury. And he primarily bought it for himself and his mates because he was a golfer and he wanted something to do in the winter because he was a fair weather golfer. And I just started from there.
And how quickly did you take to it? Did you sort of think early on, oh, this is something I really like or I could be good at even?
That's a long time ago now. It's 30 years ago. 31 years ago when I was about 5 or 6. I think my dad recognised that maybe I could be quite good at it and sort of pushed me in the direction of snooker quite quickly. I started on a full-size table when I was 7. Which there's some footage on the documentary that I made for Eurosport of me putting a few balls when I was only 7. So, yeah, it was quite a quick progression, really. Mm.
But you lived in Essex Way, which, of course, still is quite a thriving area for snooker, but certainly back then, this was like the boom years of the game. So the junior scene and the amateur scene was quite strong for you.
Very strong. You know, we had, obviously, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Stuart Bingham, there was Paul Hunter then, Matthew Stevens was, I mean, I played Matthew when I was 10 years old at Pontins in Hemsby. And it's funny because I played him in a match this season and to think like 26 years on, we're still doing the same thing and I had half decent careers at it. So, you know, it's a job for life, isn't it? Mm.
But I guess that scene sort of toughened you up in terms of the match play. You're sort of not just playing, but you're playing matches, you're playing competitive stuff.
Oh, definitely. There was the Star of the Future with a big tournaments like at Hemsby and Prestatyn, sort of 2 or 3 festivals a year. And it was constant. Brian Morgan was my coach then. The Pro-Am circuit was massive. The amateur circuit then was massive. And it was about learning your trade. And you'd go into a Pro-Am with 128 runners in a Saturday morning at Whittam, the matchroom in Whittam. And you know, you'd get drawn. I remember playing Nick Terry 1 year, and I won a frame when I was about 10, and then you'd lose 3-2, and then you'd win a match, and then it was all about progressing, and then you'd get to the last 16, make a court, have a really good run, get to a series, and then obviously finally you'd win something. But you know, that side of the game isn't there at the moment for the amateurs or the professional, the people that are turning pro, to sort of learn their trade and build up to the top level, straight in at round one, playing Mark Selby. Really, what chance have they got?
Turning pro is a big step, but you were very young. Did you see it as just a continuation of what you're already doing, or did you think, right, this is where it gets really serious now, because I'm going to be doing this for a living?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing, I was working at the snooker club as soon as I left school, working behind the bar, brushing the tables, earning a modest wage. I think I was on £65 a week. And 25 quid of that, I had to give my mum for housekeep. So I didn't really like that too much. Mm. So that was back in the Blackpool days. And I turned professional, went to Blackpool, and was up there for like 6 to 8 weeks. Fortunately enough, I had a sponsor to pay all my expenses. But it was under the strict understanding that as soon as I started earning money, it was a debt that I was into him for. It wasn't like, here's 10 grand, go and spend it on whatever you want. It was like, give me money to pay my hotel, you know, pay my tournament entry fees, and then when I won money, it got me back out of the red and back into the black, so to speak. Mm.
And what was those early days like, in terms of, did you feel like you were on the tour? Because obviously when you're at the qualifiers, it's not like being at the Crucible or the big tournaments. It's quite anonymous, isn't it?
Oh, big time. There was about 9 or 10 tournaments back in the day, and I remember, it was 10 matches to qualify for Sheffield, and about 7 or 8 to qualify for everything else. And I remember my first year as a pro, I think it was the International Championship or International Open or something. And I remember losing to Joe Johnson in the final qualifying round, 5-3. I won 7 matches to get to the final qualifying round. And I think I won 30-odd or 40 games in my first season, and that was considered a really good a good year. You know, obviously Ronnie had done exceptionally well, and he won like 75 or something. It was a route. A lot of the players at the start weren't really any good, but the first 3 or 4 matches were, you know, if you could play, you was going to win those. Mm. And it was when you started playing players like, you know, in the top 128, like Sean Lanigan maybe, or Jason Pegram, people that could play, then they'd maybe beat you because they had a few years' experience. And then you'd start overtaking them to get to the latter rounds, like the 64 players who were then Brian Morgan's, you know, people like that.
And what was your game like then? Because you're known now as like an all-round match player, a terrific all-round player. Did you have that then, or were you like a lot of young players just sort of going for everything?
Oh, I don't think I ever went for everything. I probably played a lot of the wrong shots at times, still do now. But I think I've definitely sort of developed into a hard match player, which you do with losing matches that you shouldn't lose. And I've lost plenty of those in my career, as have every other player. But yeah, if I had the game now that I had back then, then I'd have done a lot better.
OK, well, your first big breakthrough, I think, for most people was the 99 Grand Prix.
Yeah.
A BBC tournament, so a big deal. And you beat Stephen Hendry, who then was the world champion and, of course, the man to beat. What was that like? Because, obviously, this is kind of your first big moment, I guess, in the pro game.
Yeah. It was funny because my mindset, which I'm trying to work on a bit more of that this season now, I looked at it as if I've got absolutely nothing to lose here. You know, what? I relished playing him. I loved him. I loved it playing him. And I turned him over quite a few times, I think, in the early part of my career. But I remember that match. I think I won 5-2. It was at Preston Grand Prix, yeah. But yeah, like I said, I loved playing. And I found if you could get over who you was playing, you got just as many chances against him as you did anyone else. But it was the scare factor of playing him. And players would put in uncharacteristically poor performances against him. And I played my game and I played well against him. That's why I beat him a lot.
Yeah. And also, you're sort of showing everyone what you can do because, you know, you can tell everyone you're a snooker pro, but they can say, well, I never see it on the TV, you know. But that was a big occasion. Hendry was, he just won his seventh world title earlier that year. He was the man.
Yeah, he was the man. And it was quick for me to, so I got to obviously the semi-finals, and then I think a month later I won the Benson Edges Championships, which then was a really good event to win. There's some really good names on that trophy. Ronnie, Matthew Stevens, Paul Hunt and McManus, all them, and my name's on there as well. And then that obviously I qualified for the Masters when it was at the
Conference Centre.
The Conference Centre, yeah, that's it. And I played Steve Davis there. So within that 2 or 3 months of being a nobody, I'd earned 50 or 60 grand, and all of a sudden I was like back-to-back BBC events down the business end. So I come from a bit of nowhere to being sort of like a recognised pro sort of thing.
And did you feel that you were improving? Did you feel maybe your game was changing and you were developing that all-round game you talked about?
No, I don't think so. I think I was still one-dimensional then. You know, I was, you know, yeah, I was just one-dimensional and still learning the trade. I think some people, I was a young 19-year-old, or 18-year-old. Some people have old head on young shoulders, but I was still young then and probably a bit petulant and didn't have the best attitude. Same as now, really. But you can't, you know, if you rub your fingerprints out, they grow back the same. We're all the same. I've had a lot to deal with, and sometimes, you know, the frustration can get on top of you.
But there must have been an enjoyable period, though, because, like I say, you've broken through at the Masters, which is a big deal. Were you starting to feel, right, this is my career, this is not just a bit of fun, I'm young, this is a career I could do forever?
Oh, definitely, it was, you know, obviously I mixed it with the top boys and beating Hendry so early on, and then I went to the Masters, and don't forget, Steve Davis won it, I think, 2 years before that, when I played him in the first round, it was 4-1 down and won 6-5. And then Ken taught me a lesson in the quarterfinals, I think it was. Yeah, he beat me 6-0 and made 4 centuries. Some things never leave you, and that was one of them.
OK, well, you mentioned, obviously, it's well known you've had health problems, and the first one was the Crohn's disease, which was sort of, I think 2003 was when you first sort of learnt about that. What are your memories of, you must have obviously felt ill, you've gone to the doctor, how did that unfold?
Yeah, I was, I can remember getting bad stomach spasms of pain over quite a long period of time, but particularly in the morning when I'd get out of bed and I'd get out of the shower, and then I'd start getting this pain when your body starts working, and I'm going to start sweating again, and oh, it was just horrendous. And I went through lots of different tests to find out what was wrong, but it takes such a long time to diagnose. But it did really trim me up for a long time, for a lot of years. It has a mental effect on you, and obviously a physical effect, you know, a mental effect with tiredness. You get very irritable, you know, and when you're irritable and you've got bad stomach, snooker's not the best game to play because the things that can happen, So I'm not using that as an excuse for sometimes when I've, you know, probably not had the best attitude, but it certainly has been a contributing factor. But yeah, I mean, it's lived with me for 10 years really, up until the last 2 or 3 years, where it sort of left me alone a bit, and you know, my results have started improving again, and you know, now I've got the other bit out of the way, it's all good.
And what is Crohn's disease, for people who don't know? It affects your diet in particular, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a disease of the bowel, inflammation of the bowel, that stops. It's like if you get a hose pipe, bend it in half, you get that kink and it stops the water. Well, basically your bowel is just stricturing like that, so food has trouble passing through, foods that are particularly more difficult to digest, which causes an inflammation. Your bowel contracts because obviously it has to push stuff through all the time, which then causes the stomach, the stomach cramps, the pain, the vomiting, the, you know, the other side of it is going to the toilet 10 times a day, then you can't go at all. You know, it's all these things, and when you're bending over a snooker table with a suit on, it's not the easiest thing to deal with.
So how long do you think it took you to sort of get used to the maybe changing lifestyle that you needed?
Well, it was weird because it's a really difficult thing to talk to sort of justify because or to explain, because one minute you can eat something and it won't affect you. Mm. You think, oh, that's all right. But then when you're having a flare-up, you can eat it and it will cause you all sorts of trouble. Mm. So at its worst, you never really know what you're safe eating and what you're not. Mm. And it's only years of experience of having it that you know when your stomach starts to play up, just wind down the food a little bit, just like go on the soup sort of thing to give your stomach a rest, you know, where before I'd think, well, I was all right eating that last time, so I'll eat that again, and then you get pain, and it was a vicious cycle, definitely.
Okay, well, you carried on despite all that, you carried on climbing the rankings, and we come now to 2008 and the World Championship, where you had that great run to the final. Now, we're actually recording this at the Championship League, which is now in Coventry, but back then, it was the first year of it, it was at Crondon Park, and there weren't as many ranking events, nowhere near as many as there are now on the circuit, and you played in just about every group of that, and I think that match play definitely helped you, didn't it, kind of the Crucible?
It did. I think, I'm not sure what group I came in at, but I think I lost in the final of 2 or 3 events, and lost in the semis, and I played so many matches, and I earned a lot of money that year at the league, and it was convenient for me. It's 10 minutes down the road. Yeah. I'm not a lover of travelling particularly. I like being at home. So everything fitted in. And then when I went to that World Championships, although my personal life was a mess, really, I was absolutely skint, in debt, had tax bills, all the rest of it. And so that real breakthrough in 2008 sort of changed my life, really. Mm.
So we'll come to the final of the World Championship shortly, but of course you made the maximum as well early on, which was a great thing to have like on your CV, to make a 147 at the Crucible, probably that great last black. What are your memories of that? Because it came the day after Ronnie had had one.
I mean, my memories of it were, I think the score was 7-0 at the time. So it was like there was 2 frames before, so you know, I wanted to be 8-7 in front, so the worst I could be was 8-0 going into the final session. And then obviously got on 30-40-odd, and then I thought, hang on a minute, the reds, it's on here, then 64, then you win the frame, and I thought, right, you know, this is a chance now, just carry on putting one ball at a time. But then the pressure really came on when I sort of think I played a good cannon on the black with 2 reds and opened them up perfectly. So then down to the yellow, and I thought, right, you've just got to do this. This is your chance to get yourself right out of the shtuck, you know. And I remember saying to myself on the black that, it sounds stupid and it sounds a bit dramatic, but I thought, your whole life boils down to this moment. I can turn the corner here in my life, or I can miss it, and it's going to be another one of them, oh yeah, it's happened to me again, you'll be the victim again. And I remember saying to myself, come on, you swear word, you're having this, you're having it. And I fought it, and my life turned around ever since that moment.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you win the match, that's one thing, but to have that sort of euphoria and that momentum to carry through the rest of the tournament, the fact you know you've done that,
yeah,
it must have been... Well, it could have been maybe the decisive factor to get to the final.
Oh, of course it was. It took, you know, I think I was on 80 grand for getting to, for making the max, and then I think it was a quarter of the World Championships that I'd got myself in. So I was on over 100 grand straight away, and the financial pressure that took off me. Because what happened was I earned a lot of money for being young. I earned well for a young boy. And then we had the lean years when there was only 6 tournaments and tobacco sponsorship win. So from being a top 32 player guaranteed a lot of money, and being it was relatively easy to win money, to six tournaments where we was on $2,000 for winning a match and earning nothing. And I carried on spending like I was when I was earning it. And so, of course, I was young, and you do what every young person does and waste your money. 2008 sort of turned it round for me.
Mm. Okay, so you get to the final, which is the biggest match of the year. Everyone, you've grown up watching it, you want to be in the final. What were your thoughts, A, about being in the final, and B, of course, about playing Ronnie O'Sullivan, who would have been, I guess, favourite against anybody?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I probably didn't expect to win. Mm. But I kept trying to tell myself all the right things. Come on, this is your chance here. You know, he's not God. When you get on your knees and say your prayers, you don't say them to Ronnie O'Sullivan, do you? You say, you know, not that I'm a religious man, but I'm just using it as an example. In all honesty, the whole 2 weeks was too. I was just too drained to even compete. In all honesty, I think I could have competed because I was playing really well and confident. But my semi-final game didn't help me out at all. I was 15-14 down to Joe Perry, ended up winning 17-15 at about 11 o'clock at night, 11:30, and you'll know yourself, we had loads of commitments with interviews, BBC TV interviews after. I think I finally got to bed at 4 in the morning, where Ronnie beat Hendry with a session to spare, so he had that evening off, then the whole next day off, and then he's turning up at 2 o'clock fresh as a daisy for the final.
Yeah.
You know, he's hit the ground running, and I'm like, looks like I've done 10 rounds with Mike Tyson, and now I've got to go and do another 10 rounds, you know. And I just didn't have it in me, in all honesty.
But did you sort of reflect afterwards, maybe it took a few days, okay, well, I've got to the world final. I mean, there's a lot of great players who've never done that.
Yeah.
So to end the season like that, to look, I mean, because I don't think it's no accident the next season you won your first ranking title in Wales.
Yeah, it was definitely, it was a building block, wasn't it? You know, the Crondon Park was really, that you've mentioned it before to me, that was the initial spark that then fed a, you know, into a little flame, into a fire, and that was what started getting my career going. And I was knocking on the door for winning tournaments, and then obviously getting to the final of the world and competing on that, in that level, making a maximum under that pressure, I sort of thought to myself, yeah, I can go on and win tournaments. And since then, really, 2009, bearing without the year involved, I've pretty much won a tournament every year. So, yeah, it's good.
So the first one, the Welsh Open, I recall you were trailing Joe Swell at the interval, halfway stage, but then you came out and you did play great, didn't you, that session? I mean, you barely missed anything.
Yeah, I did. I was 5-2 down and won 9-5. But I was, again, I was getting in the way of myself. I was 5-2 down and wanting it too much, and just sort of, I remember having a chat with Stephen Sylvester, who at the time I was working with quite a lot of sports psychologists, and he just said, look, stop getting in the way of yourself. Just let yourself flow. Still try hard, but, you know, just sort of let go of trying to win, because it's trying to win is stopping you. You know, you want it so bad, you want it too much. And I did, and I think I made a couple of centuries, and 90 and 80 odd, and really won 7 frames in double quick time.
And did you feel, I mean, how did you feel at the end? Did you think, right, it was about time I won one, or is this going to be the start of winning more? How do you feel in those moments when you got the trophy?
Yeah, I felt it was unbelievable, because it had been such a long time coming in my career, and I had a lot of disappointing moments. To win that was very special. And I remember Woody Fawn texted me after and said, I'll be a first of many. And I thought, Jesus Christ, if I manage to win one more tournament, I'll be so happy, you know, because I know how hard it is to win. And anyone who wins a ranking event, a proper ranking event, will tell you how hard it is. And, you know, but since then, looking back, since 2009, with everything I've been through, and I've chalked up sort of four ranking events now, and the Paul Hunter Classic, so not bad.
And somewhere in amongst all this, you find time to become an airline pilot.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, as the captain, where did that interest start?
Well, I, as I said to you before, I was skint. And I was looking at my career, weren't really going anywhere. I was sort of around the 30 of 20 or 30 in the world, bearing in mind there's only 6 tournaments, so you weren't making any money. I thought to myself, I'm going to go and get myself a job. Now, what would I like to do? Something. But being a snooker player, you are a recognised person, you are a somebody, and it gives you that certain feeling that a normal job, 9-to-5 job, would never be able to give you. Although it gives you the highs, it gives you the lows. You know, it's both ends of the spectrum. So I was looking at a job that would make me feel, you know, good as a person and a professional person. And I thought, yeah, always loved aeroplanes. And I thought, I know what I'd like to do. I was fortunate enough to meet a guy who's with me today, Mike, after I lost, I think I lost to Marco Fu in the last 16 of the World Championship. No, sorry, I beat Fu in the first round and lost to Ronnie. And he came up to me in the club after and just said, "Oh, I watched you on telly and blah, blah, blah." I said, "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm an airline pilot, I've got a light aeroplane. Why don't you fancy a flight? Come up and have a little go." So I didn't follow it up. Saw him again 2 weeks later and he said, "Come on, it's a nice day, let's go up the field and get airborne."
Right.
And as soon as I'd done that, I thought, yeah, I could... I fancy doing this.
But it's, you know, you don't, it's quite a long process, isn't it? You don't just sort of pass your test in a week. You've got to, like, obviously have a lot of lessons. And
yeah.
So what was it about, once you got up in the air, that you thought, yeah, this is for me?
To be honest with you, I never really loved it. Mm. I saw it as a job, as a good job, a high-paying job, you know, a potentially high-paying job if you go all the way down the road with it. And I was looking at it like that. The more I've done and the more knowledge I've built up about flying, the more I enjoy it.
Mm.
It's like the more you know about something, the more comfortable you are in that environment, because it can be quite a daunting environment, you know. But I'm in and around, a lot of my friends are pilots, so although I'm not a commercial pilot yet, I'm in and around that talk, and my mate who I fly with all the time, he's a captain for Ryanair. So I'm doing things the right way and asking all the right questions, and so yeah, it's good.
But so is it something that, say, you decided to knock Snook on the head at some point, you could actually become like a BA pilot or something?
Maybe not BA. Yeah. I wouldn't, because British Airways, they're quite hard. The recruitment process is quite hard.
But it's something you could do for EasyJet.
Or, yeah. You know, EasyJet, my missus, Stella, she approached EasyJet last year, and they wanted to put me for a modular course and pay for it all, but obviously I haven't got the time to do it at the moment, because I can earn more money potting balls than I can flying aeroplanes. But when that reverses, you won't see me at events anymore.
Okay. Well, you got to another World Final course, and again, this was 4 years on, so it's 2012, and again... You're playing the same man again, Ronnie O'Sullivan. I mean, again, he's going to be favourite against anyone, but did you think, oh, why couldn't it just be someone else?
Of course I did. He's the only player that I felt at that time that could beat me. That I was playing really well in that World Championships, and it took a special performance to beat me, and he played unbelievably well. And I think he even said afterwards, or in his book or whatever, that was probably the best he's ever played. So, yeah, you know, it's a bit of pill to swallow, because I feel like that year, I don't think I was ready in 2008. I was too tired and inexperienced. But getting back there in 2012, I think if I'd have played anyone else, I possibly would have been world champion.
Mm. But around this period, you won in Shanghai, and then just after you won in Germany, so you were very much a top player. Did you feel... with that status that, you know, you should be in finals, you should be winning tournaments, how much pressure do players put on themselves to perform?
I don't know, it's a difficult one, because I can't really answer that question, Dave, because I was having so much other stuff going on in my life with my Crohn's and obviously the testicular cancer and all that. I never had time to think about I should be getting the finals. I was more dealing with health issues that I had, because I think it was just after 2013 in the world, wasn't it, or was it 14? 13 that I got the testicular problem, and then that was ongoing really for 2 years, because I had that done, and then I was 9 months all clear, then the lung issue came, and that was another 6 months really that I, so it was constantly trying to get better, and my snooker was pretty much on the back burner.
Okay, well, you mentioned the testicular cancer diagnosis 2013. I mean, obviously they're words nobody wants to hear. What sort of went through your mind? Was it clear what the treatment was going to be and what the sort of program was?
It was when I discovered I've got it, it was pretty much, I went for the scans and all that, and they wanted to know if it was self-contained, if it had spread anywhere else. And at that time, they was quite happy that it was just contained in my testicle, and they could just remove one, and that would be it. So that's what they did. And then they put you under surveillance for a year. Every month I was having blood tests, and then 9 months in, obviously I went for a blood test, and he phoned me up and said, "Oh, I just want you to go and have a scan, because just as a routine." And I thought, okay. So I went and had a scan, and then that was when it revealed that I had a shadow on my lung, and that was when it was clear that I had to have chemotherapy to get over that, and then an operation at the end of the chemo.
Yeah, so this is a sort of year later, and obviously within snooker we had the tragedy with Paul Hunter that everyone would know about and you would know about. You already looked like you'd beaten one form of cancer, now you've got another one. I mean, it must have just been awful.
Yeah, I thought it was curtains at the time. I really did. I just, you know, obviously all the bad things come into your head and thinking about Paul, and, you know, I thought, yeah, you know, I'm going to be another one here. It was a horrible time. But it was a pivotal moment. I think I've said it before in an interview, when I went and got diagnosed with the lung, and he said, oh, you know, it's going to be a rough ride from now on, but, you know, you can get through it. I'm treating you as curative care, not palliative. And I thought, right, OK, well, he's trying to cure me, so that's good. And my son, I came home, and my son said, Daddy, you're my best friend, and I walked in the front door, and I just thought, right, this is not, I don't care what they do to me, it's not going to beat me. I just, like, rolled my sleeves up, as you know I do, and, you know, thought, right, let's get stuck in, and, you know, they can keep pumping as much as they want into me, I'm just going to suck it up, and, you know, until it's gone. And that's what I've done.
So, yeah, I mean, it's very gruelling treatment, but I guess when, I mean, obviously in the end it was good news, you beat it, but the emotional toll it must have taken, I suppose, maybe even after the treatment when you look back.
You know, I can't explain to you, to anyone, the when you're going for scans and waiting for the results, whether the chemo's worked, and then I had to go for a brain scan because the natural path is it go to you from testicle, stomach to lung, and then it goes to your brain, like Lance Armstrong. And when you're going for a brain scan to see if you've got brain cancer, and then having to wait 3 days to then see the consultant afterwards, after you've sat in an MRI scanner like for an hour, your head is just completely gone, honestly. I was just sitting there like, what? And you're sitting in the waiting room, and I'm thinking, I can go in this room now, he can tell me I've got brain cancer and it's all over. There's nothing I can do for you. Or he can say, you're going to be all right. When you're facing that, you know, you think to yourself, how little things that we worry about in life, how pathetic they are, you know. But only in that moment, you're quick to forget, of course. Like, at that time, I'd have killed to miss the final black on a max at Sheffield and have no troubles and all that. But, yeah, that was the hardest part. The treatment was very tough. Of course it was. Had a lot of side effects. But it was the constant waiting to get to the next point for them to say, oh, and there was never any answers. Do you know what I mean? You'd say, oh, we're going to send you for a scan. And you'd expect them to give you an answer or something to go on, but they wouldn't. We want one more cycle, and then we're going to scan you again, and then we're going to scan you again, and then we want to do an operation. You know what I mean? And then nowhere through that point were they saying to me, "Oh, everything's going to be fine," you know, because they can't.
So how did you sort of keep going? I mean, how did you sort of stay sane through it all?
I don't think I did stay sane. I think I went. I'm still suffering from the effects now. I'm a little bit mad, but now obviously my family really. My mum was great. And obviously I had a big involvement with my son. He was there with me a lot.
Did he understand what was happening?
No, he was still too young. He was only three or four. But you know, obviously I lost all my hair and everything, didn't I? And but yeah, it was mainly focusing on him really, and making sure I was around. To being a father to my son.
So you came back and you played in an event in Hong Kong, an invitation event, and you won it. And it must have been nice just to be back playing, first and foremost, but to win the tournament, it was like a fairy tale.
Yeah, it was, mate. It was meant to be, David. I can't even justify how much that was. I mean, I'd only just got my hair back, and, you know, I'd played a little bit, because I kept trying to play snooker all throughout my chemo, believe it or not, just to do something. I was going out on my mountain bike and going biking, because it was in the summer, and I thought, I don't want to look like an AIDS victim or something like that, with no hair and white as a sheet. I thought, get out, get some bio oil on your head and get a suntan, do you know what I mean? So that was what I did, and I was turned up at the club, and used to get my cue out, and I couldn't feel my fingers like what Paul Hunter was like, and my vision was very blurred and all this, and I just kept trying, and I just hoped it would come right. And then I think at that tournament in Hong Kong, it was a great tournament because it was out of the limelight, although it was still a good tournament to win.
Top players in it?
Yeah, a lot of top players in it. I beat Sean in the final, 7-6, and played some good stuff. And I thought, you know, there was one chat that Brian Morgan said to me on the phone before, because I hadn't played for months, had I? And he said, Ali, don't get stressed out about playing. He said, you could have 2 hours practice, literally. Mm. He said, and you'll be back, you'll be fine. You'll be knocking in tons all the time.
Mm.
And I just thought, well, yeah, I played the game all my life. I'm not going to forget in 2 months, am I?
Yeah, and it must be nice to be back playing, because although, obviously, compared to the illness, snooker doesn't matter, actually, once you get back to it, it does matter, because it's your profession and you're a proud professional and you want to do as well as you can. So just to get back to doing what you love, but actually, because it's your profession, you want to do well at it.
Exactly. Of course, it's massive. It's always been, you know, any snooker player will tell you, it defines how you feel as a person when you're doing well. The feeling of winning and what that gives you inside is just, you can't explain it to anyone who's not won a tournament or who's not a sportsman and experienced those feelings. And yeah, I mean, it's my living. It's what provides me with, you know, my standard of living, my son's standard of living, you know, all the people around me. I'm known as Ali Carter, the snooker player, and when you're not playing snooker, you have to rediscover yourself as a person. Do you know what I mean?
But this is why I think it's good that you can still get the hump in matches, because it shows that you do still care, because if you didn't care, there'd be no point.
Oh, it hurts me more than ever now when I lose. I hate it. I hate losing. And when that goes, that's when I'll be in trouble, you know. And sometimes, you know, me and Mark Williams had a little, not a spat on Twitter, but I was winding him up and he was winding me up. And
it's not like him, is it?
No, right. And he was saying, oh, you get the ump and bang your cue, whack, whack and all this. And I thought, yeah, I remember a time when he's punched a table or two, but his way is to act like he doesn't care and he's super relaxed. But, of course, he cares more than anyone.
Mm.
And but we've all got different ways of showing it and dealing with the pressure.
Mm.
And his way is to shrug it off.
Yeah.
I wish I could be like that. But if I was a bit more like that, then maybe I'd have done better. And if he was a bit more like me, maybe he'd have done better. Mm. But, I mean, he's done amazing anyway, you know. It's difficult, isn't it? Who does do it right?
Mm. Well, you also won the Paul Hunter Classic, which, again, I guess was a special victory because it was in Paul's name and you've gone through a horrible process that, sadly, he didn't make it through to the end of.
No, exactly. And, again, I remember at Stansted Airport, I was sitting in the... And it was probably one of the... I wasn't that far into the season, of the new season, because I missed a lot of the season before. And I really did not want to go. I remember sitting in the departure lounge, and I think I phoned up whoever at the time, and I said, oh, I'm not getting on the plane, I'm going to go home. I just didn't want to go at all. And then for some reason, I don't know why, but I was talking to Jason Ferguson before we got on the plane. We were standing in the queue to get on the plane. I said to him, God, Jace, wouldn't it be lovely if I won this? And that was when he'd come out and presented the trophy and we shook hands. That's what he said to me. He said, can you remember that conversation? You won it, didn't you? And it was just, it was almost as if it was meant to be.
Mm.
I remember in the final, I was 3-1 in front, and there's a picture of Paul Hunt on the wall, and I just kept looking at him thinking, come on, this is for you, sort of thing.
Mm. And also this season, you won your latest tournament, the World Open, which is a big money ranking event, and it's sort of knock-on effects from that, not just the tournament, but you get the champions, you'll be in the Grand Prix and the Players' Championship and all that sort of stuff. It must be nice to win another tournament, another big event.
Yeah, exactly.
Got back in the top 16 as well.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, within a year, I've gone from, you know, 30-odd in the world, back in the top 16, in the Masters, won a big event, you know, gone up and after everything I've been through, to drop down to where I was and then get back up to the top again is unbelievable when I sit back and really think about it. But the trouble is you don't, you just sort of take it and you stride, and now I want to go further. I'm not looking at how far I've come. I'm not looking at that and now I'm looking at this again, which is good to sit and have a chat with you and realise all the things, where I've been and, you know, what I've come through to winning a big event again and getting my name back on the map, and like being in the Masters, and then, you know, I won't have to qualify for Sheffield this year and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
That's another thing. For everything, I think this will be my 15th consecutive appearance at the Sheffield, with all the health issues aside.
Mm.
So really, I've done well to hold it together, I think.
Yeah. What about sort of life on the tour? Some players always seem to spend time in company with other players. I sense that you're not really like that. You like to maybe just separate yourself a little bit, not get dragged into all the sort of chat and all the stuff that goes on.
Yeah, I do. I keep myself to myself for it. It's not because I'm shy or unsociable. Mm. I just don't find that I have too much in common with other snooker players, you know. I think back in the days, my early manager told me that I shouldn't be socialising with other snooker players when I was at tournaments. I think it was a bit of what Ian Dore used to say to Hendry. And I think that can be a good thing. And you know, I don't feel like I need to be part of the clique at a snooker event. This is my work.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's also, it's very easy to get sucked into talking about formats and prize money and all the little things that people talk about, where actually you might want to keep your mind clear and think about other things rather than just, you know, what's going on the circuit.
Exactly. I mean, you know, my opinion on it is nothing's going to change from what I say and what I want. So it is what it is. You know, if I was in charge, there's certain things I'd change. But I'm not, and I'm a snooker player, so at the end of the day, we've got loads of tournaments, loads of chances to earn a lot of money. And if you haven't even got to be that good these days to earn a good living.
Mm.
You know, you haven't got to be great. You haven't got to be a tournament winner to earn 100 grand a year, 150 grand a year. So for the boys that, you know, are in that level, they should be grateful. Because they half of them couldn't go and get a job and earn that sort of money.
Mm.
You know, half of them struggle to get out of bed in the morning.
Well, let's talk about your future ambitions. I mean, obviously, carry on playing as long as you can, but you've done a little bit of punditry with us at Eurosport, and you've got your flying. Have you given thought to maybe 10 years from now what you might be doing?
I don't know. I'm not sure how I'll get on actually working for anyone, being told what to do.
Yeah.
That's not... being told what to do has never been one of my favourite things.
Okay.
But I've been fairly wise with, you know, I've invested quite a lot in property.
Mm.
When I've had big cheques come in, I've always bought and added to my property portfolio. And, you know, when you've been earning money for 10 years, and over a course of 10 years, if you're hanging on to these properties, they're obviously making you a lot. Your money's working for you all the time. So, you know, if I can keep earning reasonably well for the next 5 or 6 years, then, to be honest, I won't be under too much pressure immediately to do anything for quite some time, really.
But you always you strike me as someone who actually likes to be busy.
Of course.
Like doing stuff. You had a snooker club and flying and the snooker itself and a bit of punditry. You actually, I get the sense sitting around at home would not be your thing.
I've always got to be, if I go and spend 100 quid, I want to go and earn 200 quid.
Right,
I'm that sort of person that whatever I spend, I've got to. I need it coming in this door before it goes out the front, you know. So I always find a way to make a living and to earn money. And I've got a lot of other business interests as well, which I've done fairly well. And you know, I'm moving into the property market really now, of developing with my other half. She's Stella. She won the Apprentice 5 years ago, didn't she? So she's an entrepreneur, and you know, we've both got. A keen mindset to make money, and she's been such a help to me because she's got the winner's mentality, and I've learned so much from her. It's good.
And also, I think I'm right in saying you've been working on a book.
Yeah, I have.
What's the update with that?
Me and Snookerbacker have worked on it a lot. I think he was going to get back into finishing the final few chapters. It's going to be really good. I'm not just saying it because I'm doing a podcast for you, but it will be a really good eye-opener. And I've done quite a lot of things that a lot of people don't realise. And, you know, a lot of successes and a lot of failures, and it's good. You know, it's a bit of a roller coaster story. And with the health issues thrown in, it appeals to a wider market than just snooker. But, yeah, I'm going to have to get on his case because I think I was a Brexiter and he was a Remainer, so I think we had a bit of a fallout over that.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, on that political note, we'll end it, Ali. But one thing I want to say is that it's great to see you looking so well.
Thanks.
And it's great to see you competing again, and welcome back, I guess.
Yeah, cheers, Dave. Thank you.
Cheers, Ali. Thank you.